When do you believe Tesla misrepresented the facts around one of their accidents? Ed's lawyer calling.
Oh boy, this is going great already. Maybe I need some more coffee. All right. Hey everyone, this is the Etana Cast. I am joined as always by Ed Niedermeyer.
Howdy.
And Alex Roy.
Hello.
Gentlemen, it's been a little bit too long. There's been a fair amount of news, and I just want to kind of jump right into it. So, you know, Alex, your close friend, your confidant, George Hotz at Comma AI, just grabbed his green little box and took his toys home.
Well, for anyone who has been paying attention, today, NHTSA sent George Hotz of Comma AI a letter. George was already in China when he received it, and the next morning on the Friday, he put out a series of tweets saying basically the Comma 1 aftermarket autopilot ADAS system is canceled. We'll be doing other projects in the future. You know, hello from China. Just a week prior, gone and visited him and gotten a fairly long ride in the vehicle and seen the Comma 1 in action and was very, very, very impressed.
Well, I want to pause you there really quick because can you explain what the NHTSA letter said and kind of why this was Hotz's reaction?
Well, I can't tell you exactly why. I can tell you, speculation. The letter seemed to be a fairly standard. I mean, Niedermeyer, you're probably more of an expert in this than I am. A fairly customary inquiry to a company that's making, autonomous technologies, inquiring as to specifications, instruction manuals, you know, parameters, operational domains, all the standard stuff you'd expect. And George's response was widely seen as. Not capitulation as much as running away. it appeared to look that way. I see it as something else. But I would say this. There's a great article by Brad Templeton on his blog kind of deconstructing the letter itself. And because it's the question of what Hotz's logic was and why he made his decision to cancel is almost something else. Because the letter is a very important letter because it's not clear that such a letter has been sent to anyone with that specific language. And if such a letter had been received by Tesla like 2 years ago, where they would be today with autopilot.
Well, I just from my side, I'm very curious to find out more about NHTSA's relationship and interactions with Tesla. And there are ways of getting some insight into that, and I'm pursuing those. So hopefully on a future episode, we'll be able to discuss that specifically and compare the two, because I think it'll be very interesting to see sort of how, you know, the similarities and the differences there.
I'm going to pull out two quotes that Templeton also pulls out that are really, really interesting from the NHTSA letter. One of them is, "It is insufficient to assert, as you do, that the product does not remove any of the driver's responsibilities." Now, can you imagine if Tesla had gotten that letter 2 or 3 years ago, whether autopilot would have been released without a transition warning system? It's inconceivable, because that is the essence of Tesla's defense every time there's an incident with autopilot. Whatever it is, that's the first thing they say. That's the first thing every manufacturer says and will always say until we see real level 4, level 5.
But Alex, you're assuming they haven't received that letter.
Well, I can't believe that they have received such a letter, or if they have, it's inconceivable because Tesla, as much as I love the system, does not have a transition warning system that would address that particular component. But the second quote, which Templeton pulls out, is really fascinating. There is a high likelihood that some drivers will use your product in a manner that exceeds its intended purpose. So by that standard, every car that's capable of doing over 55 miles an hour under human control has the same danger factor as, you know, these autonomous systems, which are meant to make them safer. Because every vehicle on the road at some point is driven beyond its intended I guess, capabilities or legally defined capabilities. It doesn't make any sense. So
would it surprise you though if you know after the Josh Brown thing that you know some of the communication from between NHTSA and Tesla basically you know brought up these issues and that may potentially explain why 8.0 is the way that it is.
Well, I think 8.0 would have had to come that way anyway, but I'm sure that was part of it. And it's still inexcusable. I mean, we can't really talk about this without bringing up what Hotz was doing. He had the first system I've seen that is a real transition warning system, and it was. I mean, granted, it wasn't completed, but it was better than Tesla's. And Tesla's, which is an implied system, because the only way to know the confidence level of Tesla Autopilot when it's working is by observing the situational awareness display and seeing what the system is using for reference. So if Tesla Autopilot is observing one lane line or two lane lines, that in my opinion is the highest level of confidence. And if it drops to one, the system will stay engaged. If it's the danger there is if the lane lines suddenly just go away, the system can instantly disengage. If Autopilot is tracking a car via radar, that's a very high level of confidence. But if that car goes off the right lane, you know, and takes an exit ramp, your Tesla will follow it off. So that is an implied transition system, and I'm always watching it when I'm driving a Tesla. Then you have Comma, which had an audible warning with a visual meter that was described to me but was not functioning at the time, which gave you an audible beep when the vehicle was started to move off of its track from dead center of the lane. So you had in advance notification of when the system was moving out of its, you know, optimal domain. And that is a significant advance over Tesla. And Tesla's is a significant advance over everyone else who literally tell you nothing. So it's impossible to believe Tesla wasn't developing something like what Hotz is doing. And I'm quite sure we're going to see that in enhanced autopilot. Where everyone else stands on this, you know, I'm convinced after seeing NHTSA's letter that the entire industry is deliberately halted at ADAS, and we're going to see nothing better from anyone else until level 4 arrives.
Well, I'm curious why you think that, because, right, I mean, this letter didn't say, like, you can't do this. It just said, explain to us how this works. I'm curious, you know, A, why you think this was the government basically trying to stop this? But I'm also curious why you seem to think that, you know, if Comma's system is better, but they're getting cracked down on and Tesla's isn't, like, do you think Tesla has better lobbying in D.C.? Is that what this is about? Or just explain your worldview on this.
So my logic here is that Hotz is his own best publicist, but his own worst enemy. We all know this. And if he had kept his mouth shut and kept testing, he probably wouldn't have gotten this letter for 6 more months. He probably would have had a device closer to being, you know, releasable. And he would have had to fight maybe 1 or 2 battles out of 10. Because it's not apparent to me that he had any of his ducks in a row other than the technology. He was asking for trouble by being so vocal and, you know, so out there. I mean, I find him hilariously entertaining and the technology impressive. But it is not a serious business make. And as for Tesla, I think they've been very successful in pushing the envelope, whether we like it or not, of getting their technology out front. And everyone else is just really, 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 really conservative. I mean, there is no doubt that hard-coded ADAS functionality, whether it's good or not, is something that's more easily demonstrated in its effectiveness, however low, to regulators, whereas any black box system, which is probably the only way to get to level 4, is extraordinarily difficult. And the NHTSA guidelines, in fact, are very, very hostile to black box systems. And that's what you have in the Comma. That's basically all. There's nothing hard coded in there behaviorally. And Tesla's is a hybrid system with some hard coded rules and some machine learning. So I think Hotz probably should have kept quieter about his intentions, but, you know, that's the nature of who he is.
Well, but that was also a product of kind of the way he was positioning it towards the end there, which was essentially just like an aftermarket upgrade for this particular, these particular Honda and Acura models, right? You know, because he was going at it from that approach, like, first of all, he should, like, he should be on the phone with the EVP of SEMA immediately. Like, there's absolutely no reason why SEMA shouldn't be helping him fight this battle if he's, as he's couching it, it's just an aftermarket upgrade.
Well, I'm here at SEMA right now, so please go on.
Well, if you're at SEMA right now, then you know that carburetors still rule, and 35-inch tires are kind of the standard for trucks. So it might not be the most forward-thinking party you could be at right now. But that said, having talked with some of the guys at SEMA in the past, they recognize, like, this is an opportunity for them to jump into. And you know, they've talked with, like, NVIDIA in the past of getting more involved and that kind of thing. But getting back to HOTS,
yeah, why isn't he here? I mean, apparently on the last Friday, he or Ricardo Biasini, who is his chief engineer and previously with Tesla, and a really great thinker on this whole topic, they were supposed to speak at an ADAS conference hosted by everyone's old friend Sam Abulzamid, and they canceled. And What I find incredible, and I'm going to call HOTS after we finish this podcast, hopefully he'll take my call, is that Comma's entire team should be at SEMA. It's insane that they're not. Because yesterday I walked around, and I had a chat with this guy, Sam Barros, who's a very deep-thinking engineer on safety systems and autonomy. And I said to him, you know, it would be really nice if there was an aftermarket safety section at SEMA. And he and his whole team looked at me like I was out of my fucking mind. Aftermarket safety, even as a joke, is a non-existent. The terminology just doesn't exist. And if it did, Mobileye, NVIDIA, and all those guys would be here showing the autonomous systems. And, you know, and Mobileye has, by the way, they do have a aftermarket devices which give you lane departure warning, for example. And it's incredible to me that SEMA is still not uninvaded, but the mindset doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, things do take a while there. I remember the only SEMA I went to was, I think, 2009, and at that point there was a Making Green Cool Zone, which was one Prius with the George Barris Prius with Lambo doors, the A123 plug-in Prius that no one was looking at, was right. The only thing I was interested in, and then like 12 giant ethanol-powered pickup trucks. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but what I'm saying is that this evolves, right? And it just takes them some time. I'm curious, you know, if you're there, I'd be really interested to see if you're able to talk to anybody on SEMA's policy team, sort of about this situation, engage their level of interest. I'm sure obviously HOTS would be interested, but I think we would too. I'd love to, you know, discuss in a future episode sort of what they say and how they look at this technology as the sort of premier, you know, aftermarket, industry group, lobbying group.
I will certainly poke around this afternoon. You know, going back for a second to HOTS, you know, last Wednesday or week and a half ago, I did this, you know, 10 car, you know, ADAS roundup, but really in a lane keeping roundup. And, you know, I can't stress enough that the industry has, you know, coalesced around a single icon for lane keeping. Like, the lane keeping symbol is very similar in almost every car. The button on the dash or the steering wheel, or the which lights up, you know, on your dash, like a little thing, like a little lane, maybe a little car in it, like traction control and DSC symbology. It is insanity that the behavior of LCAS systems varies so widely, because as far as I'm concerned, they're all useless. Tesla's, when it works in the correct domain, is awesome, and Comma's was right up there. You know, setting aside our concerns about whether CAN bus is a wise way to transmit control signals, it was a very impressive system. And, you know, several manufacturers I don't want to name have told me that they deliberately toned down the warning signals, and in some cases just decided to remove them because they were afraid that warning signals about lane departure would alarm the occupants. Well, I said, well, isn't a crash or death
pretty alarming? Yeah.
Yeah, pretty alarming. I'd rather have the alarm before the death happens. And they said, well, you know, we just it's just best if it's like a gentle system is best. And that's nuts. If a car is expected to do anything that's even semi-automated, then and it's going to stop doing it, every light, like literally the whole car should, like, Christmas lights should go off. The entire dash should be lit up every single time. And that the fact that that's not the case is it's madness. It's madness.
So I'm wondering, right? Do you think that, and I think both of you guys are going to have more insight into this than I do. Do you think that this the fact that regulators want to know how these systems work and approve them, you know, I think if you have an auto industry background, it's like, yeah, duh. I mean, you know, you have to get approval for an aftermarket suspension system or you know, anything. So what I'm wondering is, you know, do these guys from Silicon Valley, do they just not realize that they're getting into a heavily regulated industry? Do they know but think that they can just kind of, you know, ask forgiveness rather than permission? Like, why? How does a guy like Hotz get into a situation like this? Because it's not just him, too. I mean, his funders at Andreessen Horowitz, you know, I mean, they pride themselves on being value added, and we support our people. And you know, you would think that some kind of warnings or thought would go into this regulatory question. So I'm curious how you guys explain this.
Damon.
So this actually gets to a point that's been occurring to me for a while, and was really typified by Ed's appearance last night on, what's the show again, Ed?
What Drives Us?
What Drives Us, yeah. And so Ed was on there with some colleagues of ours, Evie Chells from Twitter, and she's awesome. But there were two Tesla defenders on there, and you know, the thing that always strikes me with these people is they're not seeing the world in the gray that it exists. They're seeing it from a purely engineer or common sense driven way, right? So when you've got a company like Comma AI, all they're thinking is, hey, is it possible? Let's just do it, right? Everything else be damned. And the rationale behind that is, look, if you're smart enough to use this system, then you're smart enough to take on the liability. But more to the point, it just seems to be this idea that the people that are massive advocates for this tend to not understand that the majority of the population doesn't have their interest in recognizing when the handoff is and how this technology works in a much more granular way. They just want to get in their car and go, where these guys are looking at it from essentially like a car enthusiast perspective. It's like trying to explain to somebody why you drive an E30 M3 to somebody that owns a Camry. Like, they're just not going to understand that. And, you know, it's one of those things that it just strikes me consistently out here that it's so just engineering focused, and it's this, you know, what they feel is a common sense approach to everything that should be adopted that just does not exist in the real world, and particularly when it comes to the legislative side of things.
Well, you know, I'm going to come out, you know, which camp I'm in. I love Tesla Autopilot. But what we need to see is exactly what Ed, you brought up, and Damon, we brought up in private. We need to see benchmarks, because if you took the Comma system, which I saw, and a Tesla, and you put them on the same road, which I drove 10 cars last week, I'd say that 8 of those 12 cars would be – their LCAS is dangerous. You know, it's just a downright – maybe 7 out of 12. I'd say the Mercedes – the Volvo, the Honda, the Comma, and the Tesla, in perfect conditions, cover a spectrum of reasonable of upgrades from no automation at all, and everything else was junk. And on that list, I'd say the Mercedes was the Volvo was a little better, and then the Honda was okay, and then Tesla and Comma are light years ahead. And if regulators want to come down on these systems, they should come down on Comma for, you know, not for the safety of the system, but of things like the CAN bus. Like, I want to know how reliable that connection is, because I honestly don't know. Does anyone know outside of Comma? Probably not. That's something that regulators should look at. But in terms of absolute safety, they can't, it's a double standard to apply, you know, apply one standard to the Silicon Valley guys, but then allow, you know, I mean, I think Mercedes has had lane keeping on the market for 3 or 4 years, and that stuff has been not good. I mean, it's in fact probably more dangerous to turn it on than to leave it off.
But again, we have two issues here, right? We have how good does the technology work, and I totally take, I mean, you're the expert on this, so I take your word for it that Tesla's, you know, lane keep and auto steer and these things, they function better than the Mercedes. And so that's clearly a technological challenge that Daimler Mercedes has to fix. And anyone else who wants to get into this space, the bar has been set for the technology. But again, where we're seeing the problems isn't that the technology is failing per se. It's the human machine interface. And we talked about this a lot on the last show. And so to me, that's why I think the comma thing, I don't see it as the regulators cracking down on it or making any kind of judgment about the safety of the system itself. What they're doing, which I think is in line with also what we've discussed about this sort of the direction that regulators are going in the U.S. with this stuff, is, you know, explain in detail all right. how this stuff works, where it works, when it doesn't work, what to expect.
Because let me share a little bit what I saw that I have not talked about publicly yet.
Okay.
All right. So I asked Hotz, I said, look, Hotz, you know, everyone else is out there with these huge mapping operations, and Tesla's out there with, you know, a couple million miles a day of data gathering. How the hell is your system, which, you know, learn, you know, your neural network going to learn sufficiently quickly in areas where you don't have testers having gathered, you know, driving data? He said, very simple. We're going to start out by only releasing, you know, a couple, you know, a limited run of units to beta testers in areas where we already have gathered data because of the location of the test community. And he said they're going to geofence it. It's just not going to work in certain markets in foreign countries. They're going to limit the device to areas where they already have sufficient data, which is very different from, like, that's the opposite, you know, of, say, Mercedes, whose current E-class drive pilot isn't networked and is a hard-coded logical system. So it's equally good or bad anywhere you go. It's condition dependent. Whereas Hotz is the absolutely the opposite. It's only as good as the prior data gathered, you know, in that area. And whatever it can suss out from, you know, similar, images it's gathered.
That presents a real regulatory problem, right? Because you're saying the system depends, the performance of the system depends on where you're using it. So how do you communicate that, right, clearly to all your consumers if someone in one state is going to see it perform differently than someone in another? I think that's a real concern.
Well, let me clarify that. Hotz said the system just is geofence. It's just not going to work in, you know, France. Like,
right.
It just won't.
But you're telling me somebody that's actually going to buy a Comma One and install it in their car isn't going to try to hack it to their own needs? Like, and that seems to be the fundamental thing, is we've got hacker culture meeting regulatory culture.
Well,
don't work together.
And I would let Hotz, you know, answer some of these questions himself. I'll tell you what he told me. But the system has a built-in, you know, cellular connection.
Right.
So it won't work without that. So if you take it to a market where I don't know what carrier he's using, where that carrier doesn't function, it's just not going to, the thing won't turn on.
No, that's the thing. You just swap the SIM card and you're done. Like, that's it. Like, I'm sure he's using like a GSM network or something. And you know, over here, it'll work on T-Mobile and AT&T. They get over there, it's Telefonica or whatever. You're done.
Well, like, I'm not here to defend Hotz's decisions or pretend to know the answer to every question, but I'd have to imagine that the system knows where it is, and it's just not going to work in France.
So I'm seeing a real – I think the regulatory problem – and I'm just assuming, you know, based on what I know, what it seems like the regulators are having a problem with, and probably what Hotz realized would be very difficult to explain to regulators, which is that these systems are going to work differently in different places and at different times. And the three things that make this very difficult to explain both to regulators and to consumers precisely how this system is going to work in any given situation is A, the learning component. These systems update and change all the time. And so depending on if you're driving somewhere where these systems drive all the time, it's going to work one way. And if you're somewhere where it's never been before, it's going to work another way. That makes it hard to explain. The other issue is, over-the-air updates, in the case of Tesla, but I think more and more are going to do this. As these over-the-air updates push, you know, the fundamental performance of these things is going to change. Well, and then that's a huge regulatory burden for these companies to explain, you know, okay, now here's how it works. You know, we explained it before. So and then the third thing that makes it really hard to explain this stuff to regulators in a way that's going to make them feel comfortable is the whole issue with deep neural nets and the lack of visibility into them. So you know, those three things, you know, are a huge communication challenge, again, both to regulators and to consumers. And I think this is something these Silicon Valley firms need to figure out.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to go back to what Templeton says about these neural nets. It's like, what systems is better? A conventionally coded system where you get, you know, one accident every 100,000 miles, or a neural net which has an accident every 150, but you can't really crack it up and understand what it's doing and ever really vet it. Going again about HOTS, this is speculation, but based on my visit, which was maybe 2 weeks ago, and what I saw, my understanding is that HOTS was not ready to answer all these questions, and that, you know, they hadn't written a manual, that the UI wasn't complete. They had very good behavior and some excellent functionality, but they wouldn't have been ready to answer all these questions anyway. And this is a letter that they probably would have been ready for in 6 months. And I really believe, and purely speculation, that this was a blessing in disguise, and he took it to buy himself time to keep developing. If not this, then a variant of this.
That doesn't surprise me at all.
Well, and I would just say one of the stories I've heard out of people who were formerly part of the Tesla Autopilot program is that the pace of that program is such that documentation, right? Anybody who works in software knows documentation is important. And I think when you're talking about a system where the flaw is not the danger, that the potentially lethal danger is not does the system function or does it not, it's does the owner know how it works and what to expect. I think that makes documentation even more important than any other software development process that we've seen. And again, what I hear out of the Tesla Autopilot program from people who used to work there is that the pace of trying to push that system forward, which is clearly it's pushing the whole industry forward, it's getting Tesla all this, you know, publicity, it's great in a lot of ways, but, you know, I mean, part of why a slower pace is justified is really doing a good job of documenting very precisely all of these changes that get pushed out to the car so that there is very good documentation so that the owners know in a lot of detail what to expect, how this thing might be different. Because again, people get used to things working a certain way, and as they change, you know, those changes could turn into real big problems.
Can you imagine? Actually, that's a great point you bring up, because here you have Tesla, which, you know, is a real company, that their manual, the majority of people will never read the manual. And if they do, they're reading it on screen in short blurbs on the in-car display. And can you imagine how difficult, onerous it would have been for Hops and his team of, you know, three people, to write a behavioral manual for a system that's incomplete at this stage? I mean, I'd venture to say that it'd be not. They could basically duplicate Tesla's, you know, and then write some variations, but I don't think that it was even possible. And that's why that's really why I think Hotz was thrilled to get this letter, because he was in China. I'm guessing that he saw it. His staff in the U.S. was asleep, and he just said, fuck it, this is the gift I've been looking for. We're going to go into stealth mode, which, by the way, when I got him on the phone on the 2 days later, that's the only thing he would say to me, which, and I quote, I got two words for you, Alex, stealth mode. And so here he is in China, probably looking at production of the comma one, now stillborn, thinking to himself, where else can I take some commas and get some beta testers on the ground and come back and we'll hear from him in 6 months. So that's my speculation.
The idea that, you know, this is the ability for him to buy more time makes perfect sense, particularly given the fact that, you know, again, it was a very accelerated time frame. You know, we always knew that HOTS talked a really good game, but we weren't quite sure about the shipping side of things. So, no, I completely agree that this letter was very much, at least for his ego, a great way to kind of relieve some of the pressure.
I would just say that, you know, I mean, I think one of the things we're learning both with HOTS and with Tesla is that, you know, pride goeth before the fall. not to get all biblical on you, but I mean, I think that you know, Silicon Valley, right? They've seen this opportunity. They're going up against slow moving conservative companies, and they know that portraying themselves as moving fast and innovation and pushing the limits and all this stuff is exciting to people, and it's great. And I think there's a certain amount of arrogance that comes with that. And I think that when you take that approach, if you don't stay humble when you're coming up, I think that when you run into these issues, whatever they are, whether the ones that the Comma faces or Tesla has faced, I think that the response from the public is very different based on, again, you know, the level. And I've seen quite a few people talk about, you know, who've seen Hotz speak in person at big events and stuff, and they think he's an arrogant asshole. And I think that they are now cheering for him to fail. And they are now, you know, spinning this as failure rather than sort of the tactical retreat that you're talking about. And so it generates schadenfreude is what I'm saying. I think Tesla runs this risk as well.
Of course, it looks like schadenfreude. But, you know, none of this would be happening if the NHTSA level system wasn't so stupid. And it's true because – and I keep coming back to Templeton because I was sleepless last night and reading everything on his blog that I, you know, hadn't caught up on. If the levels below four were not a hierarchy and they weren't sequential and they weren't all listed under autonomy levels, if everything underneath four was called like ADAS, it was ADAS 1, 2, 3, and then driverless starts, then we might have an entirely different conversation going on. Because in no universe has anyone ever suggested that anything underneath four is driverless. Semi-driverless is stupid. That's why even the term semi-autonomous is stupid, because semi-autonomy doesn't exist. It's either partially automated or fully. And under partially automated, a driver is mandatory. And so we never should have allowed – NHTSA never should have put out a level system with, you know, autonomy level starting at zero. Because it suggests that autonomy is possible or safe at anything under four, and it's not. It's just not.
I actually, it's my turn to say I can't believe I'm agreeing with Alex Roy, but I actually totally agree with you, right? Because the problem is that we have this conflation, this blurred line between, you know, basic driver assist systems, which have been around since the 90s, and you know, autonomous drive as people imagine it. And you know, I've been looking at how companies like Tesla blur this line, but I think you're right. I think by having this sort of continuum, I think there's positives, and it's the framework we have, and it's finally getting some public acceptance. But I think you're right. It does fundamentally blur the line by sort of saying that this is all one continuum. And I do think that maybe it's a good idea to think about maybe separating something that's a real autonomous system from these more, yeah, you know, discrete assist systems.
I mean, seriously, everything, it should either be driverless, yes or no, yep, which doesn't exist today, or it's ADAS, and there's an ADAS continuum. Yep. And it should be probably regulators should just come down and say that if you've got a system like, and Comma and Tesla are the closest to this, what I'm about to suggest, that offers any lane keeping assistance at all, I mean, at all in any form, then, and you have you don't have one hand on the wheel you have no hands on the wheel for more than X amount of time, then you should have seat shakers like stick shakers, like in a Boeing, and everything in the car should light up, and like literally like fire alarm should go off. And that would be a good thing. And everyone, the industry is nowhere on this, and Comma and Tesla, for all, you know, the grief they've gotten, are the only ones attempting to solve that problem. But the missing piece is government coming in and defining the levels. And that, without that, we're going to have the same conversation for 20 years.
So Ed, you wrote a piece, I think it was last week, this week?
Last week,
about kind of the black box situation when it comes to Tesla. And if you could just kind of give the listeners a brief download on kind of what's required by all manufacturers in the U.S. to provide, according to NHTSA and the DOT, and where kind of Tesla's fitting in and why there's some issues there.
And before you start, whatever you're about to say is wrong. I disagree. Privacy's already dead. It doesn't matter. Safety first, but go on.
All right. Now that everyone's ignoring me. No, so actually, I have to. I would start with this, by giving credit to Bozy Tatarevich. I'm sorry, Bozy. I know how it is to have your last name mangled, so I'm just not even going to say Bozy from the Truth About Cars, Hoonable on Twitter. He wrote a great story. Really, he gets the credit for looking into this first. And what he found, right? So there's regulation around what's called event data recorders, which are basically the black box, what we think of as a black box. That's in your car, kind of like an airplane black box. Although, got to be careful about these kinds of comparisons, right? And what it does is it records a certain amount of data immediately before, during, and after a crash. So there's government regulations for these systems, and the sort of the main principles, the sort of two different laws. The main principles that I've been looking at, and that Bozy pointed out, and I think are really important, are first of all, if you have an EDR in your car, you have to offer a third-party tool, a commercially available tool, with which anybody can read the data that your car generates. Okay, and I think that, and then that's followed up by another law, which reinforces what I see as a sort of fundamental principle, you know, in the spirit of this legislation, this regulation, which is that the data belongs to the owner. And right, that's why you have to offer a tool. And more to the point, you know. Automakers should not be able to just use this data however they want without your permission. It's your car. The data that generates belongs to you, and there has to be a relationship. Now, obviously, this whole issue has huge implications because we're really moving into a world here in which the data that cars generate is becoming almost as important to the business as the cars themselves. So there's a lot of issues here that need to be hashed out. But what's really interesting about Tesla is that they've a couple things. First of all, they do not offer a commercially available tool, so they're not compliant with this regulation. Now they say their data recording system is not an EDR because instead of just recording, you know, these bursts before, during, and after a crash, they're recording data constantly, and they say because of that we're not an EDR, and so we don't have to live up to this regulation. And then also, when you buy a Tesla, you sign over your right to that data, and you basically say Tesla can use it, you know, pretty much however they need to. And if you look at what Tesla has done, they use it to blame customers who try to blame Autopilot for their crashes. So to me, I see this, this makes it really hard to cover and to get close to the truth about what's happening in the situations where Tesla says, the driver's at fault and the driver says Autopilot was at fault. But I think more importantly, I think it seems like the regulation needs to be updated because I think, again, the spirit of these laws is that, you know, the data belongs to the driver and that they should be able to independently confirm it. And I think that because Tesla has this pattern of misrepresenting what the data says, and they've created this system in which they have the data and nobody can do any kind of third party verification of it, you know, that's a problem, and that's fueling this problem. So that's what the piece is about.
Question. Has there not been a lawsuit or case where a court has ordered Tesla to turn over the data and take a look at it?
I'm not familiar with any specific case where that's happened. It may have, but I'm not aware of any. Are you?
And when you say, no, I'm not, and I would assume that it's sooner or later we would see one, the other question then is, you said that you thought that Tesla had misrepresented the facts around Autopilot's engagement, or you please answer that question. When do you believe Tesla misrepresented the facts around one of their accidents?
So the issue I'm talking about there is that so nobody knows whether or not they're accurately representing the data when they talk about each of these individual cases because there's no ability for anyone to do third-party validation of that data. Where I establish the pattern of them misrepresenting data is when they make claims about the safety of Autopilot. Those claims tell me the way they make the claims they make and the way they make them tell me that they don't that they're not neutral third-party observers in this either. Of course, they have an agenda, and they're willing to make statistically unsound claims in order to portray their system as being safer than it is.
All right, devil's advocate. All right, do you believe, since we know that not all lane keeping is equal, how many times do you think there's been an accident where of someone in a Mercedes or an Audi or anything else on lane keeping where there was a headline about the lane keeping system being defective? I've never heard of one.
No, because I think that this shows that Tesla is trying to frame this argument in a way that makes it impossible to really get to the truth, which is that they make it out to be this is a binary thing. Either the driver was inattentive or the system fails, and they've never admitted that the system has failed. And really, no one has claimed that it is. The issue is not, is it the driver or is it the system? It's how are these systems, how is the driver and the system interacting in ways that make crashes more likely? That's mm-hmm. the issue, and it's a very complex one. And I'm not saying I have the answers, but again, because of the way Tesla frames the debate, controls the data, and then makes bad faith arguments about the data, to me, it shows the need. It shows that suspicion of Tesla is warranted, and if Tesla wants to get the conversation around this technology into a better place, they need to be more transparent. That's the only way through. They're creating this situation.
I would love, I'm going to play devil's advocate because you know how much I love Tesla Autopilot. I would love to see a study shown about the relationship between horsepower upgrades, say from the base Model 3 series all the way through the M3, and the accident statistics, because under the same logic, you would expect a manufacturer to have to show, you know, whether or not it actually is, you know, how much more dangerous is it to upgrade to an M3 statistically. It's probably a lot more dangerous.
But the M3 is not sold as a safety system.
That's
a fundamental difference.
Is not every single person who buys a car expected to maintain 100% control of the car at all times?
The problem with Autopilot is that it blurs that line. It pulls that into question.
All right, so Mercedes Drive Pilot is clearly, I think in some cases, I believe, in my opinion, it is unsafe. They don't make statistical claims as to its safety, but they do market it as, you know, one of the safest cars on the road. And yet it's got features which I believe when they're activated, my opinion is that it becomes less safe.
Right. So, and if you're driving your Mercedes, you're in Drive Pilot, a crash takes place, right? And you feel it was Drive Pilot's fault. You can get a third-party data machine to pull that data out and yourself, the driver, defend yourself and say, no, look, here's the data, give it to an expert. They can do the analysis and say, look, here, it was in lane keep assist mode. It failed to keep it in the lane. I clipped another vehicle and spun off the road. That was clearly the car's fault and not mine.
You know, right? I'm going to make it my mission starting in about 2 hours to try to find a case of an accident that occurred involving a Mercedes ADAS system and see if we can actually do that. Because I'd be curious to know whether one can actually crack open, AEB or lane departure warning system in one of those Mercedes and see actually what went on in that device. I'd love to know.
There's a black box. They have an EDR, and so if they're complying with the regulations, and the regulations require that there be a third-party system that any owner can access the data.
What's the difference between that car and, say, a Tesla? Something tells me that the amount of data about exterior factors like other cars available in the Tesla black box is a lot more than what's coming out of a Mercedes. And even if we could see what came across the CAN bus in the Mercedes, we're not going to see necessarily what all the sensor inputs were or what even was going on outside the car. And as a result, we're not really going to understand what went wrong.
Here's an analogy, right? Because it's imagine there's this eccentric billionaire who has a ton of land out in the middle of the mountains or whatever, and he starts posting all these videos and stuff about how Bigfoot exists, and like, oh, there's pictures and videos, and look at this, Bigfoot's real and gets all this attention, it's all so cool, and everyone's excited. And then there's skeptics who are like, you know, I don't think Bigfoot's real. And he's like, okay, well, prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist. And they say, okay, let us onto your property so that we can explore and find out if there's a Bigfoot really there. And he said, no, it's my private property. I'm not going to let you on. That, to me, is what's going on here.
That's the weakest analogy to come out of someone of your intellect. I'm insulted by that analogy. Look, I think we all know that Tesla's never going to let us see inside that box. Never. Until a law's passed. And every manufacturer coming out with a system, with a machine learning system, they're never going to let us see inside the box. Ever.
And there's a bigger problem with the machine learning systems, which is that you can't look inside them, right? And actually, there is an interesting story. I'll try to tweet it again today. I tweeted it yesterday, but apparently MIT or someone is actually finally making some progress onto making neural networks a little bit more visible, so you can see inside how they're actually working. And I think that that's really the key to making these kinds of systems work with the regulatory framework that we have.
So you're telling me that I've never heard anyone suggest that thought Tesla Autopilot was less safe than a human driver. Suggesting that.
Again, Alex, you keep making it this binary, and I get it, because that's how that's how Tesla wants to frame it. Because right. If you frame it that way, of course no one's going to say, you know, the computer doesn't get distracted, humans do. Everyone gets that. The issue is that the system isn't good enough to handle all situations all the time, which means the driver has to be ready to be engaged or be actively engaged. And the question is, you know, A, does the system make them less engaged in the driving experience? And B, is their level of knowledge about how specifically the system works in different situations good enough to be able to respond appropriately in these dangerous situations where autopilot says, I need help now?
And you know who had some great answers to that? George Hotz. Because basically, if Hotz was working at Tesla, enhanced autopilot, you know, early next year would have these wonderful transition features, and it would be a lot safer probably than what we're going to see.
Good. One they should work together.
Yeah, they should have worked together. But you know what happens? You get two geniuses together. You know, another thing about Hotz's system, which partially addresses, your complaint about transitions and, I guess, state of engagement. Every single one of the ADAS and level 2 systems from every manufacturer, including Tesla, disengages when you hit the brakes. Some of them allow the system to remain engaged while you have a little bit of steering input. So you can change lanes on some of these systems without disengaging the system. Tesla be clear. You touch the wheel at all and move it like 1 degree or put your foot on the brakes, it disengages. Hotz's alone had one additional safety feature. If you touched the throttle, the system disengaged, which is, I thought, a very interesting choice.
Well, that's the same with most cruise control systems. Both the brake and the accelerator will disable it.
Not in my experience. You touch the throttle and it speeds up. You let off the throttle, it comes back down and resumes the original speed.
Yep. That's my experience as well.
That's my experience in every cruise control I've ever used. And Hotz's alone, and this was his logic, and I asked him, his logic was, if you're going to offer any kind of lane keeping, then any input should disengage it on throttle or brakes. You could do a little bit of gentle steering. Because it did not have a lane change function. You had that, you did yourself. So that's a really interesting thing. And that's, you know, some people would argue, I think the Tesla people would hate that, because I know driving a Tesla, I love accelerating and settling back to the original speed. But that's where Hotz is thinking, as much as we're, you know, giving him grief, was ahead of the curve on safety. There's no doubt. So.
And I mean, to me, that's what's frustrating about this situation is that, you know, I don't deny for a second that Hotz had some really good ideas and was doing some things really right. And to me, the fact that he's right, it's his choice to just kind of, and again, I get it, he's going into stealth mode. He hasn't completely given up, but he certainly created the impression that like any form of regulatory oversight, really, which is what this was. It wasn't them shutting him down. It was oversight. That's like, you know, oh, I'm going to, as Damon said, take my ball and go home. I mean, you can't force people to choose, you know, well, we can do something that's better than anything that's out. We can give you something that's better than everything that's out there, but only if, you know, we don't have to prove exactly how it works to the regulators. Like, that's not how this works. You have to play the game as the rules are set.
That's what happened. If anyone who believes that that's what happened wanted him to fail. And I hope I don't eat my words, but I'm quite sure we're going to see him come out with a comma 2 or a comma 3, and that's going to be basically a repackaged comma 1, just better with all his ducks in a row. I hope that's true, because I'd love to have a comma 1 and stick it on my 15-year-old M5, although it's not drive-by-wire, so it probably wouldn't work.
Let me just throw something out there and get your take. So our biggest issue, and I think all three of us agree, that we need more transparency when it comes to this kind of stuff. So why couldn't the feds say, and again, I'm painting with very broad strokes here, every autonomous vehicle system sold in the U.S. has to be open source.
Well, I mean, this brings up another issue, which is that Tesla is not in compliance with its own open source licenses for other parts of the thing. It doesn't, people have requested, right? If you use, you know, Linux and some of these other things that they use, you have to be able to request the source code, and those requests have been denied. So I would say, based on past experience, assuming Tesla would just comply with the rules of open source, despite their PR efforts around, you know, patents and things like that, I think the record is clear there. So I wouldn't just expect them to do that. But again, I'm a cynic, so.
Oh, well, you are a cynic in the worst that I've ever met. But, you know, the open source thing, it goes back to the Manhattan Project and Robert Oppenheimer suggesting that, you know, nuclear technology, atomic technology, be shared with the world so no one, you know, everyone's on equal footing and no one has an advantage. There's no way, with the amount of money that's been spent in autonomous tech, you know, R&D at this point, that any company is going to let that happen.
Oh, I'm not saying they're going to want it or they're going to let it happen. But if there was a mandate that said, look, the only way we can really accurately test these systems is to allow everybody to look at the source code. And then, to my mind, you know, if we have an open system, then everybody's benefiting from it. The problem here is we're getting the profit motivation in front of the safety motivation. And I think that's where the real concern for me
is. The profit motivation is driving the safety motivation, and that's a good thing.
But that's still the end. That's still where we get to the end. We're talking about profit before we're talking about holding on to data because it's going to be so valuable before we've actually used that data to solve the problems that we're trying to solve.
Right. Which brings us to one more thing about well, maybe this is a little bit off topic, but I was sitting in I've read The Glass Cage for like the third or fourth time now, Niedermeyer.
Yeah.
And it's a great book about automation and its effects on, you know, HMI and humans. But in order to really put The Glass Cage in context, and I recommend that everybody listening to this podcast should read The Glass Cage. Yeah. But everyone should also go out and read the book Fly by Wire about the Sullenberger crash. And if after that you really want to get into the guts of automation in HMI, you should try to read a book called Understanding Flight 447. Because once you accept the thesis of The Glass Cage, which is that all automation atrophies the human, you know, intellect, psyche, soul, and reactions, you realize that there is kind of a fundamental equilibrium in human inventions, which halts just short of full automation. And that's kind of where airliners are. And that's where Boeing and Airbus have kind of come. They're different in that Boeing is more manual, you know, designed, and Airbuses are slightly more automated. But they're conceptual. Conceptually, they're different. But in real life, they have the same accident rates. So there's something to be learned about, no matter how much automation you add, the end results are not that different from had you not added it at all in terms of like the actual consequences. Crashes for Airbus and plane crashes for Boeings are about the same. And so what does that say about where we're going to be in 20 years? It probably means we're not ever going to see 100% autonomy, and that we're going to see an equilibrium of fully autonomous cars in some places, semi-autonomous cars in other places, and human-driven cars until they all rust. And that's the reality. And if people just accept that, then we should be focused on accepting semi-autonomous R&D and not hindering it. Because I think most people are going to want to have a steering wheel in their cars, but they're not going to want to be less safe than in an autonomous car. And that's where the industry is behind, and Tesla and Comma were going in the right direction. And boy, was that a rant. So,
and I think that framework of having those three different categories is a good way to think about rethinking the five-level system, right? Because I think there's potentially levels between each one of those. And I think that conceptually separate, like accepting that, right, is not going to be one of these things takes over everything. Because I think you're absolutely right. I think there will be places where cars are driven forever. There'll be places where semi-auto is the main paradigm. And there'll be places where full auto is. And the sooner we can start separating those things out, the better we'll understand each one and what our relationship as drivers and passengers should be to it. And that, you know, that educational process is every bit as important, as far as I'm concerned, as the actual technological development of these systems.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about the Tesla? What's Musk's sharing program called?
Tesla Network. Yeah.
I mean, this that what I'm about to bring up probably is worth its own episode, and maybe next week we do it. I was trying to take a fake map of like a city and a bunch of toy cars, and imagine what it would be like to have a bunch of Teslas that are autonomous, that can charge themselves in a mixed scenario of people in regular human cars, and like how that would work. And the story of the guy who had his entire Tesla, his whole Tesla paid for by Ubering, several nights a month. And then I realized that there's very clearly, when Musk announced that your Tesla, once fully autonomous, would not be allowed on rival sharing networks, then it becomes very clear what he's going to do. If you buy a Model 3 or an S or an X, and it has all the hardware in it, but you need to pay, $8,000 to activate it for autonomy, then you can imagine that there are going to be people who don't activate the autonomy, who get the entry-level Model 3, for example, who don't activate the autonomy and yet would love to make back some money on their car. So, obviously, what's going to happen is...
I see where this is going. Oh, God.
They get out of their car at home, but they can sign up to be on a Tesla network. So their car is not autonomous for them, but as soon as they get home, it drops them off and it goes and gets on the network. Because the car's autonomy is not dependent on the car. It's dependent on whether you've paid for it. It's autonomous anytime you want it to be when you're not in it.
Assuming the hardware is up to snuff. Yeah.
Same thing goes for charging. So let's imagine you buy a Model 3 and or an S and you want to charge it. So right now you go to a charging station in Mountain View or anywhere in California. It's so busy, it sucks. And
Mountain View in particular.
And there's a guy there who doesn't have your keys, who has no authority except to stand in front of your car and decide who gets in next. Well, for months I've been figuring, I'm like, how the hell are they going to manage this? Well, they'll have queue system. Like ChargePoint has like a queue app on their thing. But Tesla has something that no one – or claims to have something that no one else is going to claim for many years. The cars will be autonomous. So maybe the cars will only – the autonomy will be activated, whether you've paid or not, just for the charging sequence. So you get – it drops you off at your shopping. It goes and charges and self-queues. So the Tesla network is going to have to include a self-queuing and charging functionality, and you either pay for the full charging, and like a subscription, or you pay by the charge. But every time you get out of that car, it becomes autonomous to fulfill functions. And Tesla's also going to offer like an orbit or parking function. So there is an entire ecosystem associated with this, which may also be geofenced. So this entire thing I'm describing, which is all speculation, will only work in some areas and not in others. But you can see this coming, and you can see a fractured ecosystem is going to develop around each manufacturer's iteration of autonomy. So, GM will have theirs, Ford will have theirs, and which probably leads us, I think, now into the White House's announcement of this morning.
Yeah, just real quick here, Adam Jonas. I do want to get into this. We really should do the next episode about this, because I think the economics of this whole Tesla network thing versus sort of some of the other things that are going to be out there, I think that we could easily do a good chunk of an episode on it. So let's try to do this either next one or maybe one of the subsequent ones.
Love to.
For sure. Just to start putting a bow on it, Alex, what the hell are you doing in Vegas for SEMA?
I'm actually here for unrelated business. I'm unrelated to any of this, but also poking around aftermarket safety systems, or at least the absence of aftermarket safety systems. I'm doing some market research for Team Politzai and my jacket line.
No, yeah, random plug for expensive.
Sometime they'll come out sometime next year, and I promise you, I'll shill and whore myself out when that happens. But until then, no.
As long as we get Autonicast edition jackets, I'll refrain from comment on this.
Well, can you imagine if traffic police have to apprehend like a rogue autonomous car that's speeding or
Robo Patrol.
Like in Knight Rider when he fires like the electromagnetic pulse dart to shut down like the car is acting up.
Kit's got to go after him. Can we have a whole episode where we take Knight Rider as a roadmap for autonomy? Because
oh god, no, that's actually a brilliant idea, and particularly we should assign some homework. There's a was it Knight Rider 2000? Did you guys ever see that back in the day?
Yeah.
It was like the oh god, it was so good and so awful all at the same time.
All three of us should write like some Knight Rider fanfic, you know, based on actual things that are happening in the world of autonomy, and we'll all share them.
Well, you know, honestly, if we do that, one of the things one of the people we should get on is Alex Nunez, who used to be, when he was at Autoblog, he did these phenomenal live blogs of the Knight Rider reboot. So, I think he would have some things to say.
Knight Rider episode confirmed.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, the Autonomy Film Festival would have to start with a Knight Rider marathon.
Well, gentlemen, shall we wrap it up?
Let's.
All right. So I'm Damon Lavrinc on the Twitters, Lavrinc. Ed is Tweetermeyer, and he's over at the Daily Kanban. And Alex is, I always forget, it's...
I'm AlexRoy144 on all platforms.
Oh, God damn it, Ed. Anyway, all right, gentlemen, have a wonderful day, and I will talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
Bye. Bye.